Now, as to the PPP loan program, again, this was unfortunately one aspect of the CARES Act that really illustrated its emergency nature and the largely unprecedented circumstances that led to it. And ladies and gentlemen, that's my diplomatic way of saying that the powers that be were kind of making this up as we went along. And in retrospect, we could have done a better job addressing debtor access to PPP loans. As first enacted, the program, despite being intended to benefit the same small businesses, was not expressly available to small business debtors or any debtors in bankruptcy. Instead, Congress left that issue up to the Small Business Administration that was charged with the responsibility to administer that program. The SBA promptly ruled that bankrupt debtors were ineligible for these loans because bankrupt status, in the opinion of the SBA, was a clear indication of a potential inability to repay the loan. And remember, folks, the key to the benefits afforded under the PPP loan program was possible forgiveness of the repayment obligations, backstopped by federal guarantees. Now, not all that surprisingly, the ability to obtain forgivable loans to satisfy minor things like payroll and rent obligations appealed to quite a few debtors, and accordingly, bankruptcy courts soon began entering opinions addressing these disputes, and as we can see, they diverged. The rulings included Judge David Jones' opinion out of the Southern District that excluding debtors from the loan program constituted impermissible discrimination under Section 525 of the Bankruptcy Code. Judge Gargatta's subsequent opinion in Asteria Education out of the Western District determined that bankruptcy courts, in fact, lack the power requisite to enjoining the SBA, and numerous subsequent opinions were entered aligning with both. After a couple of circuit courts sided with the SBA, Congress, in the Consolidated Appropriations Act, clarified that bankruptcy debtors could or may be eligible for the program, but once again, it left the final determination up to the SBA. The SBA did not take the bait. Instead, it doubled down on its original position and did not abate the disputes. But finally, in April 2021, just in time for the loan program to end in the next month, the SBA promulgated a rule that was more specifically tailored to bankrupt debtor access, and it utilized an actively involved standard that would at least allow discharged and post-confirmation debtors to apply for these loans. All right. Having established the legislative history and background, let's turn our focus on the specific mechanisms that are utilized under Subchapter 5 to attempt to facilitate the restructuring process for small business debtors. And we'll then have the requisite framework for Araya and Brad to take us further into the discussion. Outside of plan-related provisions, we have already identified the standing Subchapter 5 trustee role. And as to the others shown here, obviously dispensing with a presumptive official committee of unsecured creditors can go a long way towards minimizing the time and expense required for a Chapter 11 case, especially until 2022, when increased statutory fees under 28 U.S.C. 1930 will expire. There's also reduction of statutory fees that can also be very meaningful savings of administrative expenses facilitating plan confirmation. Subchapter 5 also relaxes the disinterestedness requirements in order to expand the ability to retain pre-petition counsel without the need to outlay large pre-petition retainers to bankruptcy professionals. And finally, we have this mandatory plan status conference, which is a mechanism designed to promote and accelerate plan formulation and negotiations. However, there is a lot more to the plan-related aspects of Subchapter 5, so much so that we really should have broken this slide into two or three. But in any event, we'll just run through these quickly and then ask Araya and Brad to help us flesh them out. I think any practitioner with experience can see how some of these items, particularly the exclusivity and disclosure statement provisions, can really reduce the time and expense that are attendant to the plan process, while others, abrogating the applicability of the absolute priority rule, of course, and allowing the payment of administrative expenses over time are not necessarily directed to expense, but towards maximizing plan formulation, flexibility, and feasibility. The fact is that the absolute priority rule and corresponding diminished prospects for a debtor's owners to retain their interests in Chapter 11 has been and can be a severe disincentive for the debtor's owners to seek Chapter 11 protections for their companies, and Subchapter 5 negates this consideration head on. As to the abrogation of voting procedures and requirements, note that this is a hybrid type of mechanism that both promotes flexibility and also minimizes time and expense. And finally, Subchapter 5 expands discharge rights and results through new Section 1192, which generally does away with the discharge framework, exceptions, and deferrals set forth in Section 1141D. But please note, it retains those discharge exceptions that are set forth in Section 523A.